This is Ronnie Allen, and I have a very unusual show. It's the first time I have ever interviewed a film director. The man's name is Sean Swords, and the film that he directed, which has been eagerly awaited, is called Wages of Spin. It's a documentary. It chronicles the Philadelphia music scene from 1952 through 1963, with the emphasis on American Bandstand and Dick Clark. And if you're expecting a nice little feel-good trip down memory lane, well, you might be a little bit surprised at what you're going to hear during this interview as Sean and I discuss this film. Before I introduce my guest, I'm going to play two recordings that are mentioned prominently in the film Wages of Spin. The first one is by Charlie Gracie. This is his number one recording called Butterfly.
You tell me you love me, you say you're true, then you fly around with somebody new, but I'm crazy about you, you butterfly. You treat me mean, you're making me cry, I made up my mind to tell you goodbye, but I'm no good without you, you butterfly. I know what I'll do. I'm flipping your wings. You fly in a sphere, 'cause I'm crazy about you. You butterfly. Then you fly around with somebody new, but I'm crazy about you, you butterfly. You treat me mean, you're making me cry. I made up my mind to tell you goodbye, but I'm no good without you, you butterfly. Love you so much, I know what I'll do. I'm flipping your wings, you fly in a sphere, 'cause I'm crazy about you, you butterfly.
That was Charlie Gracie and Butterfly. Now let's take a listen to this wonderful ballad by the Crests that became a rock and roll classic with Johnny Maestro in the lead. This is 16 Candles.
Happy birthday, happy birthday, baby. Oh, I love you so. 16 candles make a lovely light, but not as bright as your eyes.
That was The Crests with 16 Candles. And now it's time for our discussion of the film Wages of Spin. Roll it. Here is Artie Singer, the producer and co-writer of Danny and the Juniors at the Hop.
Where do you think Dick Clark made all his money? Initially, where do you think he made it? From guys like me. Granted, I cannot say anything derogatory. I can't say anything bad because I owe my success in the record phase of it to Dick Clark. You want an inside story? Harry Rosen was my distributor. Harry Rosen comes to me and said, Artie, he said, you're not going to believe this. Dick won't play the record unless you give him 50% of the publishing. I said, what? He said, you heard me. The record does not go on the air until you give him 50% of the publishing. I said, now, Harry, you tell me. Do I have a choice? Didn't even say no. Just shook his head.
Which record was that?
At the Hop. Wouldn't put the record on the air until I gave him 50% of the publishing. But I have to love the guy, you know? It's a bittersweet situation with me, because without him and without me saying go, there'd have been no At the Hop, no Danny and the Juniors. From the inside, I was right in there. I was right part of the whole scene. And I saw this whole crummy situation develop with everybody with their hands out and grab, you know, 50% of publishing, writer's fees, and this and that, and artists getting screwed.
Now that had to be really difficult for Artie Singer to make a statement like that. Such mixed feelings. I mean, what can you say? Ladies and gentlemen, today the subject of our show is Wages of Spin, a new film which examines the Philadelphia music scene from 1952 through 1963. And the film focuses primarily on American Bandstand, Dick Clark, Paola, and the teen idols of that period. And it was directed and co-written by Sean Swords. And I have Sean in the studio right now. He is not over the phone. Sean, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. I also got Blake with me, who's one of our other producers.
Hello, Blake.
We got Blake Wilcox.
Hello.
You're a cameraman, too?
I do camera work, technical work, producership, all that bunch of stuff.
This is the first time I've ever interviewed a film director, so I'm a little bit nervous. Should I be?
Now, this has actually happened a couple times, because even though this is a film, it's obviously the subject matter is about a radio and television icon.
Absolutely.
And a DJ, you know, maybe the most popular DJ of all time.
Right. A lot of people don't realize that he started out in radio before he did the TV. He's a television icon, but that was not where he got his start. We just heard from Artie Singer, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Artie later, but I do want to say who he was. He was the co-writer of At the Hop. He produced the record. The orchestra was the Artie Singer Orchestra, and he played some of the piano on it. Not most of the piano, but he did the part where it goes, let's go to the hop, and it goes bum, 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 bum on the piano. That's Artie Singer. He passed away a few years ago. How did you meet up with Artie and get him to tell this particular story? It was at the very beginning of the
documentary. Yeah, actually, Artie was involved in the making of At the Hop. But, you know, Johnny Madara and I believe Dave White actually wrote the song, too. I think the three credited writers are John Madara, Dave White, and Artie.
Yeah.
And Artie, we had actually done a piece before this documentary film on a 1950s entertainer, singer, guitar virtuoso, Charlie Gracie.
And Rockabilly Giant.
In the Rockabilly Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah. He's great guy.
Yeah, several Hall of Fames. Actually, in the English.
You might as well mention what the name of your film was.
It was fabulous. It was actually a big hit on regional PBS. I think it was, what, two summers ago?
Yeah.
Two, three summers ago, yeah.
Yeah, so during the course of the first dozen or so interviews, we had several entertainers, you know, prominent musical icons, allude to it was a shame what happened to Charlie, or what happened to Charlie. So obviously we were all looking at each other during the interviews and kind of had an idea of what they were talking about.
We want to give people an idea of what this film is about. As I indicated in my introduction, we're talking about a time period, 11 or 12 years, actually 1952 to 1963, you could actually say that's 12 years. And I guess 1952 is when a show called Bandstand began. Is that correct? It started out as a different show, though, on the radio, right? It was, like, inspired by a different show?
Yeah, the actual Bandstand show started in 1952, and the original host was Bob Horn. I believe Ed Hirst and Joe Grady were actually offered the show first, but they couldn't get out of the contract that they were in at the time. They had a real popular dance show during that time frame. So Bob Horn was the original host of Bandstand and hosted it through 1956 when it was still a regional show.
But initially it was a radio show.
Yeah, it kind of segued into the TV
show. How I don't quite understand. If people are dancing, how do you get the feel for what's going on the radio? I mean, part of the appeal of watching Bandstand was watching the dancers.
Oh, yeah, that's why it became as popular as it was, because you actually had to see the kids. Now, you got to remember, there was little dramas going on with the kids, too. There was kind of like an ongoing soap opera. Mm-hmm. So you didn't just have the music. You were emotionally vested in the kids that were on the show.
Right.
Like who was hooking up with who, or who, you know, was having a problem with who, or who didn't like who. And at the time, that was really appealing to kids because, you know, even when it was regional, it was a big hit before it went national. One of the more popular aspects of the TV show was always the kids.
Absolutely. And we're going to get to the kids in just a few moments, but we're going to start with Bob Horn. A lot of people, in fact, including myself, when I first watched Bandstand, I thought that Bandstand was just there. Dick Clark was the original host. But we're talking about a gentleman who was quite a bit older than Dick Clark, wasn't he, Bob Horn?
Actually, I don't think he was that much older.
But he looked older.
Yeah, that was the thing.
he didn't look like America's youngest teenager or oldest teenager or whatever.
I think he was in his 30s at the time, but you know, he was a little more weathered-looking.
The thing is, he looked more like a
paternal.
He looked like a grandfather, perhaps.
Well, the kids thought of him more as an uncle.
Like an uncle. Yeah, okay, uncle. Absolutely.
Yeah, he was an avuncular figure.
Avuncular. I like that. I like that word. What kind of a personality did Bob Horn have as far as hosting the show? Was it very different from the way Dick Clark eventually hosted it?
You see, one aspect of any kind of filmmaking where you're dealing with people in historical perspective is people have different opinions of a person the way that they perceive him. I guess universally, he was perceived as, like you said, avuncular. He was accessible. The kids really liked him. You know, we've done dozens of interviews with people that actually knew him.
Right.
First-person interviews. And for the most part, like I said, not even most part, universally, he was well-liked, you know, and he was accessible, which was later became a problem.
When did Bob Horn host Bandstand? From 1952 through when?
1956.
Now, at the time that Bob Horn was hosting it, was it strictly a local show in Philadelphia?
It was a local show, but it was a stopping point. Remember, you had to break records in regionally back then. You couldn't
right.
do it not till Clark had Bandstand, and it went national in 57. That was, you know, one-stop shop, and you could break a record with one play on Bandstand. But you used to have to do it regionally, and he was the biggest one in the Philadelphia metropolitan area and in that region. But he was also known nationally as a lot of the provincial DJs that were very popular were back then.
The show was popular, there's no question about it.
Oh, yeah. It was one of the higher-rated shows in Philadelphia at the time, and it was also, with the kids, obviously, it was enormously popular. And he was a celebrity. You know, how it used to be kid shows and radio shows and local television shows, the people were regional celebrities back then.
Right.
And Bob was, you know, at the top of the, in the hierarchy of local celebrities in Philadelphia.
Bob has passed away.
Yeah, he died a long time ago.
A long time ago. While Bob Horn was hosting Bandstand, what was Dick Clark doing?
Dick Clark actually came down from, I believe, Utica, New York.
Mm-hmm.
His father had a station up in upstate New York. And actually, you know, depending on who you talk to, it seems that he came down, obviously, for more opportunity. And he had had an introduction into the Philadelphia broadcasting community through his father, who had some connections down here. And he was doing stuff that a lot of the DJs were doing around, jumping from show to show. You know, there was radio shows, right. There was television shows that they...
Actually, I heard that he started out as a sportscaster. Is that just a rumor, or is that true?
Yeah, that might have been up in Syracuse. Like, he did some stuff for the college, I believe, up there. And then he was in Syracuse, and he was always ambitious. He was looking to get... And one thing you got to remember, he always looked at this as a business. Was smart, you know, and he knew that the higher profile opportunities would eventually be television, and they didn't have a television market like they did in upstate New York here in Philadelphia, so obviously he wanted to get in. His father provided that opportunity for him with his connections down here in Philadelphia.
Right. So therefore, Dick Clark was primarily on the radio end, but he also did some fill-in work
on the TV.
Yeah, he had had his own show at a point before that, too. So when Horn got in some trouble in 56, there was a couple candidates that were apparently up for the job, and obviously Clark was the best fit all around.
Let's talk a little bit about the trouble and why it disrupted, basically, Bob Horn's career and changed his life, not for the better. I think the first disruption was a DUI.
Yeah, there was a couple things that were happening kind of simultaneously. You had, I believe, two drunken accidents. There was a sex scandal with some of the local notables and some girls in a, at the time, I guess it was a suburban area right outside the city.
You're talking about underage?
Yeah, and it was proposed by several people that Bob Horn had been having relationships with some of the other girls that were involved. So all of these things, obviously, for a person that was in the position or capacity that he was, especially as host of a kids show, you know, he actually had to go to hearings, and there was pictures of him posted where he was arrested in handcuffs. And
not exactly the image that the TV station wanted.
No, I believe at the time he had just signed a new contract, I think a three-year contract, and at that point I think he was offered to keep the radio show. He balked at that. I mean, he had his attorney's files.
Well, this is even after all of those charges were
going on. Well, it was really embarrassing because Walter Annenberg owned Triangle Productions and owned the Enquirer, he owned the show, and his wife, Lenore, who just passed away recently, actually had a drunken driving campaign. She was spearheading it for the paper and the community.
I am Ronnie Allen, and I'm so pleased to have in the studio with me Sean Swords, who is the director and co-writer of the film Wages of Spin. And we also have in the studio Blake Wilcox, producer. Oh, okay, now I know who produced the film.
I'm the comedy, he's the tragedy.
Oh, okay. You know, I mean, I don't...
How much sleep we've gotten.
I guess I have a little bit of problem knowing the difference between a director and a producer. I almost, you know, would have associated you as the director-producer, but it's like...
Yeah, we have a couple other people that are really key components of all this. Conrad Zimmer actually put most of the script together. You know, we came up with a format and obviously all the plot points that needed to be touched on, and the substantive part of the template, I guess you could call it, and he filled in most of the blanks in the editing process because he's an Emmy award-winning editor, and he's also a great cameraman, and he was our cinematographer for most of the shoots on this. He shot most of the footage. And then we have our executive producer, Paul Russo, who actually facilitated a lot of the interviews with a lot of the music icons that are in it because of his connections in the music industry. Yeah. And then we had John Jackson, the author, who wrote great rock and roll books on Alan Freed. He's a walking encyclopedia. He's actually one of our producers now, and he's been an extremely valuable asset to us. Well, kind of, we all wear multiple hats. I believe the term is hyphenate. You know,
speaking of a multiple hat, you're wearing a Phillies hat now. That's one of your multiple hats.
Got my $42 Phillies hat on it. At the parade, they were charging people $42 for the hat. I think somebody stole my other one in the parade, so I had to kind of get a $42 hat.
Now, just in case some people don't see you yet as a household name, I just want to ask, Sean, very briefly, tell us what films you've done. You did Fabulous with Charlie Gracie.
Yeah, we did Fabulous. That was, like I said, a big hit on regional PBS, and then it was picked up for worldwide DVD distribution by Gotham Distribution and Oldies. They own Oldies. It became a big hit on DVD. It's, all the major retailers have it available online. And then we did a documentary on an Irish group called Blackthorn. It was on UPN a couple years ago. And we're working on a sequel, actually, at this point. Probably shot about a dozen interviews and are collecting archival material for a piece on the Philadelphia music scene from about 63 when Clark left to about 78.
We're going to get into Gamble Huff.
Yeah, we're going to get into the Philadelphia Internet.
Stylistics and all the great groups.
And there's a lot more of these people that are still around, too. Yeah. So, it leads to more letters.
That's true. Sadly, one of my favorite people from that era, Linda Creed, great songwriter, passed away many years ago. And she wrote so many great songs. I look forward to that documentary as well. What gave you the idea to do this one? Did you just one day say, I want to do a documentary about Bandstand, or was this something that developed over a period of years?
No, I said it became pretty apparent. It was it was simple deductive reasoning that when we were doing the Charlie Gracie interviews that we're looking at each other and saying, you know, it's pretty funny how everybody's asking what happened to Charlie Gracie, or not funny, kind of, actually, that, you know, what
happened. Well, he's still alive and performing, so let's look at the bright side there.
Well, yeah, I mean, he should be a household name. I mean, he's revered in musical circles, like Ray Davies, George Harrison, Paul McCartney,
yeah.
Van Morrison. He's gone out on tour with Van Morrison. A lot of people didn't know what happened to him. He was the real goods. He was, you know, a guitar virtuoso that inspired a lot of people,
right.
Graham Nash. But when he came back from his first big tour promoting Butterfly, he came back to the U.S. and he asked where his money was for his royalties.
That was a mistake. Maybe.
Yeah, at the time, his label.
That was a no-no.
Cameo. Bernie Lowe, the owner, told him that, you know, kid, you get your lawyers, I'll get mine. So he thought Charlie would balk at that, and he did. And he sued, and he won for a settlement out of court. You know, another
but
coming
was
back
it,
to
was
simple,
it worth
yeah,
that
the
settlement
reasoning.
And,
he got blacklisted. You know, he's a whistleblower, and his. You don't go from having the number one hit in the world to no airplay within a couple of years because your records can't get played. He left Cameo Park, or Cameo was it at the time?
It was Cameo at the time. That's right. Yeah.
Way later.
Right.
And he was replaced actually by Bobby Rydell, and that label went on to enormous success in big part because of their connection and relationship with Dick Clark.
And then eventually
Chubby Checker,
Orlons,
Duvels,
they
were all there.
Right.
But what had happened was it ruined Charlie's career. He signed with other big record labels and could never get any airplay.
Yeah.
And somebody of that ilk in that town should be getting airplay. You know what happened there.
Yeah.
So,
he was making great records. In fact, some of his records continued to sell very big in England.
Oh, yeah. The Europeans, in particular the English, are real aficionados. So they know what the real goods are. They're not interested in fabricated pop stars who came through.
No.
They like the guys who got the goods. And Charlie, you know, like I said, I keep coming back to the term of virtuoso, but he's also somebody that was a great mentor to a lot of these English.
Yeah.
Dick Clark had 25% of the publishing.
We're going to get to that. we're talking about Dick Clark now, but as of right now, Dick Clark is still not hosting the show. Bob Horn is hosting the show. So was it after, like, the second DUI conviction that they decided, hey, we're going to have to get rid of Bob Horn? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I mean, he was just getting too much negative press, and there was legalities involved, and, you know, they had to replace him. I mean, it was a train wreck at that point because of the bad PR.
Right.
And that's when there was a couple candidates up for...
Interesting. But the ratings still stayed good, didn't they?
Well, yeah, the kids were...
But, so it was like...
Well, they didn't care.
The kids didn't care.
So it wasn't hurting. I mean, did any sponsors pull out, as far as you know? And say, we're not going to sponsor you if you kept this going?
No, what happened was they were smart. You know, they right away... They got another DJ in there, and they picked somebody that was perfect for it at the time when you had Dick Clark. I think Johnny, a couple people that were mentioned as replacements were Bill Weber.
Bill Weber was one, and there's another one in the film, Johnny something.
Johnny Carlton.
Yeah, Johnny Carlton.
But Artie Singer told us he was in the studio when
Dick got the word,
They just reached in and go, you're on tomorrow. You know, it was like, that's how easy it was. And during that time, most of the information that we received or the interviews that we had were, it was Clark really was the catalyst for bringing that national. I mean, there's probably a lot of other reasons. You know, Walter Annenberg had a lot of great connections, and he had a TV guide. And
but so initially...
They balked also at that. I mean, they really had to be pressured into that.
It's
the network,
to do it, really. Because, well, it was a gamble. What worked in Philadelphia would not necessarily work nationally and not necessarily in every market. But they brought Dick Clark in, and now is a good time for me to mention some of the people that are in this film that you will see on camera. In no particular order here, well, you mentioned Charlie Gracie, of course, and Charlie is a very important part of this film. Mike Love and Bruce Johnston of the Beach Boys. Frankie Avalon, Len Barry, lead singer of the Dovells. Also somebody named Fabian Forte. Plus, he was just Fabian back then.
Fabiano
Forte. And then if we're going to do that, it's got to be Constance Frankenero.
I think she has three names.
Got three.
Yeah, anything with more than two syllables gives me problems.
All right, I'll call her Connie Francis. Then we have Ernest Evans.
Chubby Checker.
Good, very good. And we have a guy named, sometimes called Mean Joe Terry. It's really Joe, what, Terranova?
Joe Terranova.
And Frank Maffei of Danny and the Juniors. And Mark Stevens of the Dovells. Stephen Caldwell, he's one that goes, Lord, won't you, on the Orlons record. The one male voice of the Orlons. Dick Bocelli, member of the Comets. And Dave
Dick Apple. Richards, now. Yeah, just for entertainment.
Oh, okay, fine. And Dave Apple. Remember the Applejacks?
He was actually a very talented guy.
Really? I didn't know too much about him. We got a few more. Bob Marcucci. Bob was one of the two heads of Chancellor Records, and Bob's partner was Peter DeAngelis.
Yeah, you know, obviously Peter passed away several years ago, so we had to interview Bob. And, you know, another thing, you know, we don't want to force feed the audience too much, but you can usually tell the people that have another itinerary or aren't telling the total truth or true, you know, I don't want to say lies by omission, but they just don't talk about certain aspects, or they revise them.
Shading their version.
Well, yeah. When you have a project of this sort, and you ask people to tell what they remember, sometimes the recollections could be right on the money, sometimes they could be just a little bit off, and sometimes they could be just like they dream.
Totally invalid.
Yeah. But you present these, and then people can really judge for themselves. Artie Singer, of course, we described at the beginning what he did, and of course we can't forget our gal Sal. Sally Starr.
She was bigger than Clark at one point, Philadelphia was a kid's show. And then you also had Bill Weber, who ended up Wee Willie Weber. You had Johnny Carlton. Ed Hurst is one of the more candid people we met. He was supposed to be the original host of Bandstand, him and Joe Grady.
There's one that we have not mentioned yet, and she is one of the most articulate and knowledgeable people, and that's Raleigh James.
Yeah, Raleigh is one of our linchpins. You know, Raleigh holds the narrative together. She's a walking encyclopedia of pop music history. Her and John Jackson, the author, actually are two of the people that are really familiar with the subject material. Raleigh and John are both very articulate, very well researched, and they both know what was going on, and they were two of the narrative, our vertebrae. They actually held the story together.
There's one other person that we have not mentioned and also fell into that role of the narrative and holding things together, and man has a nickname called the Geeter, Jerry Blavitt.
Yeah, Jerry, you got to remember, first-person account. He was very close to Bob Horn. He was the original lead dancer for Bandstand, the original show. Here's another great little anecdote. When they transitioned from a provincial show, well, even before they transitioned to a national show, when Clark was picked to replace Bob Horn, Jerry led a boycott the first day outside the studio.
Wow. And, that's right.
And Clark came out and asked them to come back in, and out of loyalty to Horn, Jerry was the only one who didn't go back in, and I believe he was the only kid that was ever paid for being on Bandstand. He was getting like $25 a week, and then I think Dick or one of the people in the studio told him they would give him $50 if they came back in, and he didn't come back in, and subsequently he was let go from the show. They arrested him, they put him in jail. He was 16 years old, and he stayed loyal. I believe when Bob Horn went down to Houston, he got some trouble down there too. So this is just what
this is wasn't just in his, okay.
Yeah. So Jerry went down there with him, and then Jerry came back and obviously had a prolific career in regional radio.
I am Ronnie Allen, and I'm so pleased to be talking in the studio here with a film director, a man by the name of Sean Swords, and he's directed a film called Wages of Spin. And it's all about the Philadelphia music scene. And I am laughing because Blake is once again giving me his card here to remind me that his last name is Producer. It's Blake Producer.
Yep.
And his middle name is Wilcox. Sean Swords directed and he co-wrote the film. And he's the one that kept saying, cut, cut, cut. That's what directors do. Do all directors go cut? I mean, is that what you do? Cut?
No. Yeah, not with the documentaries. I mean, we just kind of let them. If you notice the style that we shoot it in, you rarely hear us speak.
Yeah.
Any of the interviewers.
So I think in all.
Oh, I'm going to bring up a point. Okay, can I bring up a point about Artie Singer? Thank you. When Artie Singer did his little dissertation at the very beginning of the film, and we used it at the beginning of this show, he didn't mention the name of the recording, which was At the Hop. That was the missing piece of the puzzle. So you were kind of in the background, and you had to kind of prompt him, or what was
Yeah, well, what happened was, you got to remember where he just naturally segued. You know,
yeah.
you don't hear me interject much. I think that might be the only time in the whole film.
Yeah.
Is he was talking about it before that, but then he segued into this, do you want to hear a story? You know, do you want me to
yeah,
tell you a truthful story?
But he didn't tell what the
story
was about.
Was, but he had said it before that, but where we cut into it, you know, he hadn't mentioned it
right.
from that point on, so we had to put it in the proper context.
Didn't even say no. Just shook his head.
Which record was that?
At the Hop.
Probably it's one of the best aspects
yeah.
of the whole film because
yeah.
you got a first person account
oh,
which you had to give to get.
That's why I opened the show with it. And by the way, that was your Alfred Hitchcock moment. He had a moment in every one of his films, right?
Actually, that's for trivia. For trivia, that is the only time any of us have ever appeared in any of the films that we worked on.
Wow.
And that wasn't even
it was just a
visual appearance. It was just
it worked. Dick Clark took over the show. Was it on a 1 day notice?
No, they had been pushing for it for a little while, and they finally got a trial period for a couple weeks with the network.
When Dick Clark took over the show from Bob Horn, the show was still a local show, right?
Yes, it was provincial, and it just continued with same success. It was a turnkey operation.
My question is, Artie Singer was in the studio with Dick Clark. Dick Clark is being told, you're going to be doing this show. Was Bob Horn given like a 2 weeks notice, or was it the following day, Bob Horn, you're out?
Once they cut him out, he was done and Clark came in.
The next day, Dick Clark was doing the show.
Jerry led that boycott of the show, and they got Jerry out of the equation pretty quick, sent him to jail. And he started right away. And of course, like I said, this is an important aspect of all this. It was a turnkey operation. He inherited all his contacts. He inherited all his connections. He inherited everything that Horn had. You know, other extracurricular things other than the show. Business
relationships. In other words, well, did Horn own publishing? Was
oh, yeah. There was, you know, this has been going on
for
a long time.
So, in other words, we have to make a point then that this is not just, even though we're focusing on Dick Clark or focusing on Bandstand, this is something that probably went around throughout the country, locally, people. It's not Dick Clark who's the only person that ever did anything like this.
Oh, yeah. You know, when you start digging a little bit and you start talking to a lot of people, you realize that it was systemic. You know, it was throughout the whole industry. It wasn't just Dick Clark that was, you know, doing this. He was just happened to be the most popular, the highest rated,
absolutely
highly visible DJ.
Particularly, yeah, once he went nationwide, that's when it really was obvious.
And he turned out to just be much better at it than everybody else.
The point is made by several people in this documentary. Connie Francis is talking about, and I think Frankie Avalon and Fabian talking about what Dick Clark meant to them in terms of the exposure, and Connie talked a little bit about the kids. Everything just seemed to work. The show seemed to be the right place at the right time, and then it became a national show.
Yeah, it happened in 1957. I believe it was, like I said, a little tired. It's been a long week for all this with the PR and the film.
But in a good way.
Yeah, I think it was August of 57. It was around that time. It had a couple-week trial period. And it was an immediate success.
Okay. I seem to recall watching Bandstand that even when it went national, there was a portion of the show that was only seen in Philadelphia, like the first hour of the show or something, the first day. Do you remember what I'm talking about? And then the rest of it was nationwide.
Yeah, part of the show was on locally, and then it was transmitted nationally. The other part.
It was always like that.
Yeah, and, you know, it was 5 days a week.
I assume he had guests on during the local show as well. Did Dick Clark put the high-profile guests on where he might have had more interest on the national version so they would get more exposure and have acts that he had no involvement perhaps in, like on the local? That's what I'm wondering.
No, I mean, that would make sense. I'm not sure.
I don't know.
They would appear on the show. That would make business sense if you were just going to have them for exposure for the national aspect of it. But I'm not sure if they were on there for the entire show or if they were.
Okay,
they would come on at the same segment all the time to pitch their records.
But I'm just talking about if you're on just in the Philadelphia area, you're not reaching the audience that you're going to reach nationally. The film does try to be balanced in terms of saying, you know, the show was good for a lot of people. It was good in a lot of respects. And people loved American Bandstand. People watched American Bandstand. People were glued to their sets. Dick Clark became a huge star, almost bigger than life. And then,
as was alluded to earlier in our film when you're watching it, Dick inherited everything from Bob Horn, so he inherited his business relationships too. then when they went national, he just had a higher profile platform, and it was such a huge success that right away people came a-courting to get their records played, you know, and they would do anything they had to do it. And so the $50 handshake kind of disappeared with a lot of the provincial DJs.
Right.
What was given to Clark was copyrights.
Copyrights.
You know, one person said in the film, you know, that there was a suitcase of cash that they bought down for one of their songs, and it was bigger pieces. And then Clark was vertically integrated into all the aspects of the music making industry.
And
at the
by
time.
Vertically, he had a hand in just about everything.
Yeah, he was
vertically, and he even used the term vertically and horizontally. He admitted certain things that we're going to hear Dick Clark's actual statement in a few moments. But I want to talk a little bit about this record called 16 Candles. I think that that's a good example of what we're dealing with here. Recording came out on a small label called Co-Ed Records. Great song, but everybody shrugged their shoulders, and it basically flopped. And then what happened? How did Dick Clark involve in that?
At that point, now here is where conjecture comes in, or speculation. The fact of the matter was that Clark was assigned the copyright. Whether he asked for it, or whether it was given to him, or proposed to him, you'll never really know. But
this
what
was
happened
after,
was...
This was after the
this
record
was flopped.
After
it was
after
flopped. Yeah, they played it a couple times and it made no noise.
Yeah.
The trick has always been to lean on the record. If you play something once or twice, it's not going anywhere. It has to chart, it has to move up the charts, it has to get a lot
people
of exposure.
Need to hear it, yeah.
Kids, to get them to go out and buy the records, you got to lean on it. You got to hammer it. So what happened was then Clark was assigned the copyright and it started to get played every day or regularly. And after that, it became a pop standard.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was, I think it was number
huge.
Two that
number
year.
Number two, got to
number
two. Huge, huge record. But Dick Clark didn't just have publishing. He had his hand in the record labels, too.
Mm-hmm.
Even pressing plans.
Yeah, there's one good story here. He owned a record, or was involved, had partial ownership, or I don't remember if it was full or par, in a record pressing company that had no physical record pressing equipment. So what would happen is they would take the orders, his company, and then there was another company that did the actual pressing of the records. I think it was Ed Hirsch said in the film, you know, somebody say, hey, we got 50,000 records we need pressed. It doesn't hurt to have Dick do it. You know, so he would get the order and get paid to press 50,000 records, and then he would give it to their, whatever you would call it, subsidiary or their, you know, company that was the front that they were for, and they would press the records. But I mean, he had his hands in record publishing, which was enormously profitable.
Yeah.
Talent management. I believe he managed Dwayne Eddy.
Oh, Dwayne. Now Jamie was Jamie Philadelphia based?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now when I interviewed Dwayne, I had actually for many years thought Dwayne was from Philadelphia because he was on Jamie. Dwayne was from another part of the country. But Dwayne did have a share of appearances on Bandstand. I mean, Rebel Rouser got Rebel Rouser to death.
Well, there was one case, I believe, where they, here's the adage where people say, does the airplay make the record, or does the record make the airplay? You can't make a bad song good, you know, those kind of axioms. Dwayne Eddy had a song played, I believe, 27 times before it charted. You don't play a song on Bandstand 27 times to get it to chart. It has to chart a lot quicker than that, but it charted. So
27
yeah. So you could. They were smart enough to know not to press something. There came to a point where you didn't keep pushing it if it's not going anywhere. Then it's obvious that, you know, if a record ain't charting and you're pushing it, there's some kind of self-interest involved.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, did play some records quite often which did not become hits. I mean, not every record that Dick played became a hit. But let's face it, I'll give you one good example. He used it in the dance contest. I thought it was a great record. Billy and Lily, who did La-Di-Da, and they did a record called Lucky Ladybug, and they also did a record called Happiness, which I thought was a great record. Dick Clark decided to use it in his daily dance contest. And so it got played every day for 20 days in a row. But the record just didn't sell. So you can't always turn a bad record into a hit if it's a bad record. I didn't think it was a bad record. It was a good record. However, a record that is reasonably good, that needs a certain amount of airplay, it could put it over the top.
There isn't an infinite amount of records that can be bought. Right. You know, the market only can sustain so many big hits and
right.
so many records that get sold. So obviously some good songs probably slip through the cracks even though they played them. Now another, not a point of contention, but something
sure.
to consider is with the records that get played, did these people approach Clark or did he handpick the ones that he wanted to bring in? Obviously by getting a copyright,
well,
you're going to have an interest and want to play it, but you're never really going to know, except that, you know in the case of Artie Singer that he sent him to him, an emissary.
Yeah, well, Artie told his side. You've got to wonder, though, did that happen with everybody? Did it happen with most?
I think he could pick it. If you looked at it and
yeah,
used simple
yeah.
deductive reasoning, he could pick because everybody wanted their records played, so they're
right.
going to give him that.
Well, what you just brought up is very interesting because it's something that I would have thought the congressman
mm-hmm.
later on, 1960, would have focused on a little bit more, like how do records get played? How do you pick who appears? How often does the record get played? Which ones do not get played? And there are a lot of questions that were not answered then. We're getting to that point, but before we get to that point, most of the public was introduced to a term before Dick Clark was taken like under the carpet, so to speak, in front of those congressional hearings. The name Alan Freed came up. Payola became a major thing in the news. Let me ask you this, Sean. Was payola illegal or just unethical?
It wasn't illegal, but the problem was there was no real legislation or statutes, whatever you want to call them, to address it. I mean, obviously, if you come to somebody and say, I want to give you $50 to play my records, that's commercial bribery.
Right.
But I'm not sure if this is a real gray area. Whether that was really illegal or not. But if I'm in the position where I can play your record and I tell you that you have to give me cash, gifts, or money, or a copyright, or anything of value in exchange to do that, or it won't get played, that's extortion, and that's illegal.
Right.
So that's why I said it keeps coming back to who approached Clark with something of value in
right.
exchange for the airplay, or did he send people? But he could handpick what he wanted, so it just made sense that he
yeah.
would reach out to the people that owned the rights to music that he
well,
wanted
he
a piece
could,
of.
He could do that, but he could yeah. also claim, well, I'm just playing what the public wants to hear.
Well,
we're getting fan letters, and they want to hear this, and they want to hear that. But we get to 1960, and they have congressional hearings. Congressmen look also very serious. They probably don't really understand rock and roll or anything, but they're looking at what is payola, what are we going to do about it?
That helps explain why they were asking the wrong questions, too.
Well,
because
yeah.
they weren't familiar with it. They didn't understand it.
Maybe they didn't want to get Dick Clark. I don't know what was involved here. Here is what Dick Clark said on the subject.
I have sworn under oath that I have never taken payola. I frankly admitted to the committee that I have, as countless other entertainers have, invested in numerous enterprises allied with the broadcasting and music industry. I've engaged in these activities very actively. I have made money from my efforts, and in many cases have not invested a great deal of money. This happens to be the nature of the entertainment business, where on small investment you can reap large returns. I have never taken payola.
You know, I found that statement very interesting because Dick did mention that he engaged in a lot of activities. He made a lot of money from those efforts, but there's one thing that's not really connected here. Maybe the congressman could have zeroed in on this and said, now, wait a minute. Certain records got played a lot. How did they get played? Why did they get played? Or they could have said, did your interest in these companies have any effect on what records got played and how often they got played on the show?
No, they did address this.
They did?
Yeah, there was. What happened was Clark said maybe, you know, subconsciously or whatever, here's an important aspect of all this, is that these guys did know what they were doing. They knew what he was up to. There just wasn't laws or legislation that they could apply to this to convict him. But these were hearings to enact legislation to prevent this from happening. When
right.
Clark made that comment, he didn't say that he was asking artists for copyrights in exchange for airplay or it wouldn't get played. You know, the congressmen did their homework. They knew what was going on. They knew the kids on the show were signing checks back to him. for their appearances on the show to his company, Click Corp. You know, that in itself is very unethical. I mean, these kids really weren't getting paid.
What was called Click Corp?
It was Click Corp was his production company, and they would get an appearance and actor fee for being on the show, and he would make the kids sign it back over. But they were asking some of the right questions, but I said they were there to kind of indict him as far as for his participation in it, but they weren't there to convict him and send him to jail.
Well,
they were just trying to enact legislation.
The way I see it, the congressmen asked questions. There were a lot of dots, but not all the dots got connected.
No, they proved it. They charted the songs.
Well, they did.
That
they
he
did to a degree.
No, I mean, this is fact. They had every song that was played, and they showed what percentage they were playing in reference to songs he had an interest in.
So actually, the congressman did prove,
they did prove that,
this,
that he was.
This went on. This cause and effect did go
on. And his response was, I didn't do it intentionally. It might have been subconscious. Now, another really important aspect is they said, well, payola, what is your definition of it? He kept saying that if you saw what he said in the live interview from Congress, I have never taken payola. Well, he used a very limited scope of that term.
What it is.
He said there had to be an agreement between the people bringing me the records or the rights or the money, and that they would give it to me
in exchange
for airplay.
Yeah.
But they said to him, what do you mean there was no agreement? What, did they communicate this to you telepathically? That, you know, you're going to play this record and we're going to give you this. He said they were gifts, or they were gratuities that they were given him, but he never agreed to play the song. That's ludicrous. It's just common sense. You have to have an agreement. They're not going to give you the copyright to something and you not play the song.
But now, if you own 25% of the publishing on a song, and as a result of that ownership, you play the heck out of that song, is that a form of payola or not?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but they don't call it payola.
Yeah, cash, gifts, or money, anything of value in exchange for airplay.
In other words, okay, but if you're just doing it by virtue of the fact that you own the publishing, it's still a form of that particular umbrella.
It's supposed to be a level playing field.
So?
And it wasn't, most of the time, it wasn't 25%. Our 25% was Butterfly, 50%. For at the hop, a lot of people were given 100%. I believe the entire copyright was given to Clark for 16 Candles. So most of the time, you weren't assigning a portion of it. You were assigning the copyright.
Right. Okay. What happened as a result of these hearings? What did the congressman do? Was there legislation passed?
I don't believe so. I mean,
after all of this hoopla,
not that it really meant anything, because I'm not sure if anybody's ever been sent to jail.
The only thing that I think might have happened, and I'm not sure of the time frame here, but I do know that ABC made people throughout the country who were involved with the selection of records, including Alan Freed and people like Dick Clark. Okay. They try to make everybody sign some sort of an agreement. In fact, that's in the film. You have your DVD player, you could actually slow it down. If you ever get this on DVD, you'll be able to read what the contract says. And what's interesting to me is Alan Freed refused to sign it on principle. I don't think Alan Freed ever admitted taking payola, but he just said, I'm not going to sign that on principle, is what I believe he said. Dick Clark, on the other hand, was not compelled to sign it. He was allowed to come up with his own agreement. So maybe I'm missing something here. What am I missing? Is it that just Dick Clark was bigger than life? It was the cash cow for the network, and therefore you couldn't afford to let Dick Clark fall? Is this what this was about?
Yeah, he was the golden goose. I mean, Freed had one affiliate up in New York, a popular one, and obviously if one employee, I believe it was one employee, Clark, was allowed to tailor make, Congress derisively called it a Christian Dior document. And Clark had signed his own agreement, and I think a lot of the gist of it or part of it was, you know, that there was no agreement in place. Remember, from Friday to Monday when they recessed, the tone changed of the hearings. They were really going after him in the first part of the hearing. They wanted to know what was going on. They recessed for the weekend. Monday he comes back. At the end of Monday's hearing, they basically apologized for having wasted such a nice young man's time. It seems like simple deductive reasoning. Somebody got to them over the weekend. You got to remember, he had Walter Annenberg behind him, who was one of the most powerful men in the country, and he had the ABC network, which was now really becoming powerful, in a large part due to that show being on prime time 5 days a week, more sponsors, generating a lot more revenue. So something happened. The tone of the hearings changed, and the subsequent fallout from this was, obviously, there's one other aspect of this. In New York, they could compel the DJs to testify against the record labels, or the record labels to testify against the DJs. In Philadelphia, they didn't have that power. Okay. So that's part of the reason that Freed went down, was because they could get him in New York for payola. And obviously, there had to be some scapegoat, so Alan Freed's career was basically destroyed, and Tony Mamarella, he actually was the producer that was with Horn. He taught Clark the ropes. They were very close. He explained all the business aspects of it to Clark, and he functioned as a producer and one of his best friends throughout the run, his tenure at the show. And when the payola investigation started, Tony was also compelled to testify. And after the subsequent, I guess you would call it fallout, Tony had to leave as the producer of Bandstand. Clark actually called him up and told him, you know, Tony, you're going to be the fall guy. I don't want to get into it too much because part of it is covered near the end of the film.
Sure.
There was the relationship between the two was severed as far as Bandstand was concerned. You know, these labels and everything that they were involved together, I'm sure that they kept their interest in
Clark. The bottom line is Dick Clark never had to make any sort of apology on his show for himself. Did he actually do that announcement on the show?
Yeah, I think he said that...
Did he mention him as by name, or did he just...
I've just learned that this person close to me, they read it
That's
verbatim.
It. Okay. It wasn't by name. They didn't mention it by name. Okay.
Has engaged
but
in activity.
It was Tony.
Basically passing the buck.
One other thing I want to mention without letting the cat out of the bag, the film does address what Dick Clark had to do when he was given a choice of either divesting his interest in the companies or... Well, I'm not going to say what it was. We'll let people see how that's revealed in the film. Too many cats out of too many bags here. We've talked about the history of Bandstand. I want to touch on one more thing, and that's the human interest element. What this means to a person who's trying to make it in the business. Now, we know what it meant to Charlie Gracie. Charlie Gracie, you could argue, kept
career
his mouth
was sabotaged.
Shut, but if he had kept his mouth shut, maybe he would have had a few more big hit records. He would have had the relationship continue with Dick Clark. We can speculate on that. It's quite possible. But what about people who didn't play the game, didn't have the money to play the game, they're on small labels, they don't have as much chance to get played on Bandstand, and they may have as much talent as some of these people that make it, but they don't get a chance to be heard. Isn't that kind of a human interest?
Yeah, two of our primary points of contention with Clark and the way that the industry was at the time was the show, too, is that a lot of people did not get the opportunity to perform on the show, to promote themselves, because artists that Clark and the independent record labels in Philadelphia had an interest in were getting an undue amount of airplay on the show because of the vested financial interest in them. So a lot of other artists were deprived of that opportunity and were not able to do that. And another thing is there was a human cost to all of this that was taken. There was the money that people that actually created these songs had the rights to were deprived of. When Dick Clark had to divest himself, he sold the entire publishing rights and took that money, and that was a big part of financed Dick Clark Productions. It became one of the most successful independent television production companies of all time. But these other people, you got to remember, there was like 146 copyrights, something like that. It was in that area assigned to him, which was basically given to him for nothing, or next to nothing, small percentage. And he took those songs and made millions and millions of dollars off of them. A lot of the people that we've interviewed were people that we've talked to, that people that they were involved with creatively, died penniless or are living in squalor. There's a 50-year residual effect to all this. People were deprived of those revenues in the mid and late, or actually more closer to the late 50s.
Right.
They really could have used that money. So this isn't just an oldie story about what happened.
Sean, what are the plans for the film now?
Actually, Wednesday, April 1st, we're showing it at the Philadelphia Cinefest. It just came across one of the wire services as one of the 12 must-see films for the festival.
Right.
Some of the people that are involved in the film, some of the entertainers, are going to be at the exhibition on April 1st at the International House at 6:45. We actually have a lot of this information posted on our website, www.characterdrivenfilms.com. After we go through the film festival circuit, you're looking for distribution. We've already had a couple producer reps approach us and some of the distribution, some cable outlets, about licensing or selling the film to them. So the bottom line is you want to sell it, and
obviously,
we want to put our energies into the sequel.
But you see this like as a TV film primarily, or a theatrical film?
It's going to be up to the distributor. You know,
okay,
obviously,
you
want
to go either way.
Oh yeah, you want to get it into theaters, even if it's in a limited release like art house theaters.
Right.
But if that doesn't happen, we want people to see the story. One of the reasons we did this was because, you know, this was. These people were aggrieved. I mean, there's some social elements to this film that are important that people need to explore, and I really believe that Dick Clark's position in pop music history definitely needs to be reevaluated. You know, it's one thing to see him smile and is, you know, an attractive host of the American Bandstand and want to emulate him or to respect him because of his business acumen and his success. But it's also another part of him that needs to be explored and to be put into the public forum, that this man took a lot of intellectual property and things of value that didn't belong to him and abused his position as host of Bandstand. He should have been looking out for the interests of those kids that were on that show and the people that were bringing him music, managers, distribution companies, not exploiting them for his own financial gain. I really believe this is a really socially relevant film that really needs to be Dick Clark explored in that whole concept of giving things of value in exchange for airplay, because there always is a human cost to all of this.
There's not a boring moment in the film. It is riveting. It is fascinating. It's going to make you think. It's not necessarily going to make you happy, although there are some happy moments in it. It's very comprehensive. As I said at the outset of the show, Wages of Spin is the film, the Philadelphia music scene, 1952 through 1963. And Sean Swords, I thank you so very much. And also, last but not least, he is your closing act. I got to mention him. Sean, do you have anything to say before I...
Actually, Blake can give you other information as far as the contact and the company.
Blake? Okay.
Good night, Ronnie, and good night everybody else out there.
I hope it was worth coming in the rain to do this.
No, like I said...
No.
I mean, no, not like no. I'm
you
not negating.
No problem at all.
This is great. You know, you need people to hear this story. You need the people to know what was going on. This, like I said, it's not irrelevant. 50 years of financial woes incorporated into people's lives that shouldn't have been there, that's worth addressing in a public forum, and it's worth evaluating the, you know, Dick Clark's position in all this and how he affected it. This is, in our opinion, and a lot of people. Let me tell you one other aspect of this is, at a lot of the screenings, people have had a really strong emotional feedback on this piece because they didn't believe and they didn't know that this was going on. They were upset. A couple of the artists were questioned why they didn't do anything about it. They were teenage kids. Our culture in general doesn't like people being exploited by people that are powerful.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of what this is about also, is its exploitation.
Well, Sean, I wish you good luck with the film, and can I let Blake have the last word?
Yeah.
Well, any closing thoughts?
Go see the film. Come see us. Charlie Gracie Fabulous is out there. Support the local artists.
Long live rock and roll.
Absolutely.
¶¶